Well, another day and another court result. The Court of Appeals, the Ninth District, San Francisco style, San Francisco Street, has come out and shut down again, preserving the ban on the ban for Trump. And I've got some quotes here for you. It was a 3-0 decision against the United States government, the position that the government had a right to ban or to delay the incoming immigrants. And basically, and the judges were William C. Canby Jr. from Jimmy Carter, Richard R. Clifton from Bush, George W. Bush, and Michelle T. Friedland from Barack Obama. Here are five aspects of this order, which is about 30 pages long. Rather than present evidence to explain the need for the executive order, the government has taken the position that we must not review its decisions at all. We disagree. They wrote, in short, although courts do owe a considerable deference to the president's policy determinations with respect to immigration and national security, there is no precedent to support this claimed unreviewability, which runs contrary to the fundamental structure of our constitutional democracy. So the administration had argued that the court didn't have the right to review an executive order related to national security threats, saying it was under the president's broad foreign policy powers. But the panel disagreed, citing a Supreme Court case in which it ruled that U.S. courts could hear Guantanamo Bay cases. They refused to say whether it was religious discrimination, but they did say that there were significant questions there that needed to be answered. And here's another part of it. Aspects of the public interest favor both sides, as evidenced by the massive attention the case has garnered at even the most preliminary stages, they wrote. And they said there was a powerful interest in protecting national security and preserving the president's authority, that it was essentially a split topic that the government, the states, and the president had interests that were important to the people. And here's another part. The government has pointed to no evidence that any alien from any of the countries named in the order has perpetrated a terrorist attack in the United States. The judges said that there was no hard evidence that the banned countries, Iraq, Syria, Sudan, Iran, Somalia, Libya, and Yemen, posed a risk for terrorism. All right, then they come to this part where they say there's a right to life, liberty, or property, that the Trump administration didn't convince the court on this, and the court said the government has not shown that the executive order provides what due process requires, such as notice and a hearing prior to restricting an individual's ability to travel. So this is probably the most extraordinary part of this, and they also add, we cannot say that current interpretation by White House counsel, even if authoritative and binding, will persist past the immediate stage of these proceedings. All right, so I don't know if it's shocking, but kind of the maybe ominous idea here is that people who live in other countries have a right to due process, including being heard. Now, the implication is that the due process is due if they have an interest here, but it's you could easily see how this would become part of this global citizen argument. The United States is the most powerful country in the world, the most important in terms of economics and politics and everything. So why not take our Constitution and apply it to the whole world? I mean, that's kind of bubbling under the surface here. Here's a little clip from Fox News.
The Supreme Court, or will he let the temporary restraining order stand and go back to...
I didn't have that at the beginning. Here you go.
We have gotten word from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. They have upheld the lower court ruling from Washington State.
Anyway, they have upheld it. And so the quotes that I had just read to you are from the ruling itself. Neither the judge in Washington State nor the court offered anything approaching a detailed discussion of 8 U.S.C., the United States Code 1182, the law which specifically gives the president authority to suspend the entry of any aliens into the United States if he believes their entry would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. And that is really probably, so you have the two arguments there, that the judges have a right to come in and say that these people have an interest in America, they have standing in America, these basically saying that these people, even though they're not citizens, have standing for their due rights to be heard, to be given notice, to be able to go to court. So, I mean, how many people are they going to apply this to? It's really a kind of a shocking idea. Once you've applied the U.S. Constitution to everybody in the world, I wonder if you're not really kind of just invalidating the Constitution. Because if it applies nowhere, I mean, if it applies everywhere, it seems like in a sense it's considered to be a universal law, then I don't know. It just strikes me as being a very odd ruling. And, it is out there, it has been stated that the U.S. government in its argument did an extraordinarily poor job in defending the ideas. But I mean, if the president has the power to make these decisions, the court just took away that power and gave it to itself. It did not really go into too much whether, you know, on the law. But if the president, you know, if the president has that as a right, then the court shouldn't come in and take that away. It just seems pretty obvious, no matter what your position is. But I think you've got a lot of snowflake liberals in these courts. You have people that are basically social justice warriors in the federal court system even. Here's from Krauthammer.
This is a Fox News alert. A federal appeals court has upheld the block on President Trump's travel ban from 7 Muslim-majority countries. The past year and a half, of course, has given ample proof that the president is not deterred by a setback, even those that would have destroyed more timid politicians. It's no surprise, then, that he immediately vowed to fight on, ironically saying he would see the court in court. Has the president finally found a fight that he can't win, and where do we go from here? To tell us, we're joined by columnist and Fox News contributor, Dr. Charles Krauthammer. Charles, thanks a lot for joining us. So what exactly is the court saying here? I'm trying to understand what the central objection to the president's executive order is.
Look, I think this is a disgraceful conclusion, because what they did is they substituted their judgment as to what constitutes a threat to American security for the president's. Now, we were all interested in what they think, but that is irrelevant to the case. The case was, does the president have the authority to do it? And if he does, it's his judgment to make. And that's the plain reading of the law. It's the plain understanding of the Constitution. I think the policy was unwise, but that's irrelevant. I think it is very clearly legal. This is the most left-wing, most overturned court in the country. So I think for the administration, and considering that Trump does not like to lose, I think he may want to go to the Supreme Court, which may not be the most tactically wise way to go. But you know that he tweeted out, see you in court? Well, I'm told that the governor of Washington State just tweeted out, we did go to court and you lost. Now, that is sure to get a rise out of the president. And I suspect out of a matter of pride, he's going to want to go to the Supreme Court, where I think his chances may be dicey. So there's just no slam dunk, even though I think if we had a full court, if we had Scalia, or if we have the new justice, he would win. But we're not sure where it goes. Remember, as you know, Tucker, if the high court splits 4-4, then the ruling of the Ninth Circuit, the one we got tonight, stands, and the president loses.
Now, I've heard some speculation about the case that the Justice Department lawyers, the career attorneys from DOJ, made before the appeals court. And I've heard a number of people, attorneys, say it wasn't a very apt case. They didn't do a very good job, and they seemed a little light on detail. And at one point they were asked, well, name the threat. Be more specific about the threat that the U.S. may face from these seven countries. And they didn't seem to have the facts with them. Do you think it's possible that they didn't make a very good case, and that they didn't make a good case because they don't believe in the case?
Well, on the first question, I was listening in to the oral arguments, and the Trump side, the federal government side, was, I thought, exceedingly weak. I don't think they were throwing the game. I don't think this is a guy who went in there deliberately to lose. I think this was a junior guy. I'm told the top two were unable to do it for whatever reason, had to recuse themselves. And remember, I think this is a mistake, a tactical error by the administration. You don't go into a decision like this, executive order like this, where you know you're going to get sued. You know you might get stayed unprepared. They did it before having an attorney general in place. So they are dependent on the career people who are not necessarily the top of their class. I don't think this was a guy who was playing the 1919 White Sox throwing the World Series. I think he just wasn't. He was a minor leaguer who was, you know, had to bat in the World Series.
All right. So they've lost. And so here's a couple of questions for you that I was thinking about last night. One of which is, you know, if this was poorly argued, was this a winnable case that was simply ill presented? And I think my reaction to this so far is that this is what the court, this is the outcome that the court wanted. And we've been talking about the rule of law. The rule of law says we're all under the same law, and whether you want the president to have this power, or even if you think that he's misusing it, if he has the power, he has the power. And the left, a group of people, or a theory of life that I pointed out to you, has no real jurisprudence. It doesn't really have there's a million leftist legal theories, but if you boil down leftism, there is no legal theory that is left. You know, there's no residue. There's no leftism is about outcomes. Leftism is about redistributing funds, putting rich people in their place. It is about centralizing power. It's about having one party, you know, all of these things. So anyway, we'll take a little break here. AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450. If you want to put in your opinion here, a little more little feet for you. Trouble. This one's dedicated to the Donald. Be right back.
You yelled, hey, when your car wouldn't start. So you got real nervous, started to eat your heart out. Now you're so fat, your shoes don't fit on your feet. You got trouble, and it's tailor-made. Well, mama, lay your head down in the shade. Hope your eyes are tired, and your feet are too. And you wish the world was as tired as you.
All right, so we just have this ruling out of the Ninth Circuit, and it seems like the justices said, number one, that the U.S. government didn't prove its case that these people were dangerous from these areas, and number two, you've got to remember that these people have due process rights. Now, that, you know, to me is a real stretch. If you're not a citizen, if you're not living in the United States, you know, it's a real problem in my mind. But I guess you could argue those people had been promised to be that they could come here and that they had their visas and everything, and therefore they had a vested interest, but they don't have standing as citizens. But, you know, if somebody's living here and they're not a citizen and they're a legal resident, they have standing for application of the Constitution. If somebody's here illegally, they have standing because they're in the territorial area of the United States. They have standing to be prosecuted for this crime, even though it's a bit of a slam dunk. They still are given constitutional rights. So I guess all you're saying is you're applying it overseas, but I think it's a bad... It is a bad development because now you can start using it in these overseas rights in a lot of different settings. Here's a little analysis from a Napolitano. Intellectually dishonest group of judges on the Ninth Circuit. Hold on one second here. I got a little bleed over. And I was looking at some New Mexico news for you. And New Mexico just lost a fight on water rights with Texas. So I'll tell you about that in a minute. Here is Judge Napolitano right now.
Napolitano, Fox News chief judicial analyst. I'd like you to talk about this issue of the court trying to sort out, on the one end, this is a court, not the president, saying we're not persuaded by the president's argument that this is a national security issue of so much urgency that you need to take this step.
It's precisely the wrong thing for the court to do, Chris, when you have the following observations, which are beyond dispute. The Constitution assigns the decision-making for foreign policy exclusively to the president. Even Congress has a subordinate role, subordinated to confirming ambassadors and ratifying treaties and paying for the State Department. The president has a lot of tools that the Congress has given him. One of the tools is the statute that he read yesterday, which we've all been talking about, which was exercised by President Carter and by President Obama, a blanket ban on immigrants from given places. The statute specifically says the president on his own by proclamation, meaning he doesn't have to consult with anybody else, can make this decision. The decision to ban is not reviewable. It's not justiciable. Judges are incapable of second-guessing the president on it. So for that reason, he may be thinking the Supreme Court is going to invalidate this. I don't know which way the Supreme Court's going to go, and I don't know which court he had in mind. But this is an intellectually dishonest piece of work that the Ninth Circuit has produced tonight, because it essentially consists of substituting the judgment of three judges for the President of the United States when the Constitution unambiguously gives this area of jurisdiction, foreign policy, exclusively to the president.
But Judge, let me ask you directly about what I was just talking about here with the panel. I can't remember all of the details, but there were several cases that went to the Supreme Court after 9/11 involving enhanced interrogation, involving
yes.
Guantanamo, and in those cases, the Supreme Court said that President Bush had overstepped his bounds and that they, as the court, were saying that what he had done was illegal. Why is this different? Not on the merits, but on a matter of principle.
Okay. Great question, Chris. You are speaking of six cases in which the Bush administration was challenged by detainees at Guantanamo Bay. It lost five of the six. The one was on an issue because it was filed in the wrong court. The five that it lost all had the same issue at their base, and that is, if the government seeks to exercise its powers extraterritorially, like in Cuba, does the Constitution follow the government? And in all five cases, by different majorities and for different reasons, the conclusion was the same. The Constitution follows the government. This is precisely a different reason. This is not whether or not the Constitution governs the government. This is whether or not judges can interfere with the execution of an area of the Constitution which unambiguously gives the authority exclusively to the president. That's why this is so profoundly wrong. Let me add another gloss to this as to how complex it truly is when the president says in his inimitable way, see you in court. There are 47 lawsuits, each in a different United States district court. This one in Seattle is just one of them. The Chief Justice of the United States, who bears the same name as our colleague John Roberts, should consolidate all of these, and he can do that this evening, and very well say it's not going to be tried by Judge Robart in Seattle. It's going to be tried by Judge Ammon in Brooklyn, because she also issued a nationwide injunction. So we're really in untested, untried, virginal territory here with a highly politicized Circuit Court of Appeals that assumed the powers of the presidency by second-guessing him and overruling him.
All right, so I just want to add something in on this. I think what you're looking at, and I'm sure you're drawing the same conclusion, the administration was a little bit hasty. They were a little bit disorganized when they brought this thing forward, the way that it played out. Now, I think that they chose these countries because the United States itself had already said that these are problem areas. It was in the law. They felt like they couldn't be challenged. What if they had put in, for the sake of the argument, Saudi Arabia, where these hijackers came from? Then you couldn't say that that there was no danger, that there had not been any attacks from these areas. On the contrary, what if they came back with another ban just from countries where we can prove that they're exporting terrorists, right? So I don't know if, that would have changed anything, but what we're dealing with here is judicial activism. We're losing the idea of the rule of law. To be a good person in the past meant that you followed the law. To be a good person now, according to popular opinion, the media, Hollywood, the upper echelons of the Democratic Party, means that you do the right thing. Now, the theory of natural law was that there was should be by design in the government a connection between the law and justice. But the natural law, in trying to do that, admits that those are not the same exact thing. You've got the law can be applied correctly, it can be misapplied. In leftism, you've got this development of an idea that there is justice and you go directly to justice, or if you have to, you go through the law. If you can't get there through the law, you go outside of the law. So it's a very, very dangerous and a very illusory decision. And let me ask you this. How would you decide on this issue yourself? You know, what standards would you use? We'll take a little break here. Kelly O'Connell, AM Los Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450 at 633, and it's a little bit warmer outside, and I'll get my phone for you and find out what the exact temperature is when we come back.
Well, I'll write a letter, and I'll send it away, and put all the trouble in it you had today.
Answering this question myself, how would I rule? I mean, I think what you have to do is go to the law and then look at the action of the president. I mean, that's all you can do. If you begin to say things like, well, this decision by the president isn't justified by the background of these countries or the inconvenience to these people or their due process rights, I think you're really getting into something that could backfire. And, I mean, you have to stick with the law. What else do we have? Here is a little interaction between Tucker Carlson and the Washington, D.C. Attorney General. I don't know who this guy. D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine. I don't know anything about this guy, but it was kind of an interesting conversation. Check it out. Gets to some of the issues in the decision on banning the ban.
The
legal opposition to President Trump's executive order is Carl Racine. He's the Attorney General for the District of Columbia. He's one of 16 attorneys general who signed an amicus brief supporting the lawsuit against the president's orders. He joins us now from Washington. Mr. Attorney General, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Tucker.
In the ruling tonight, there was this line, and I'm puzzled by it. It says this: the government has not shown that the executive order provides what due process requires. Now, this order applies mostly to foreigners, non-U.S. citizens abroad. They're in other countries. The question, I think the key legal question here is, does due process as afforded by the Constitution apply to them? And if it does, it has massive implications for a lot of things. How could we ever bomb people in foreign countries, declare war on them, drone them, without giving them due process if they're due the rights the Constitution affords U.S. citizens? Does the court really mean to say that due process applies to foreigners in other countries?
Well, I think the court's focus on due process was related to the impact of this executive order on immigration law. And clearly, with respect to due process applies to citizens in the United States, residents in the United States, as well as individuals who have applied and been granted visas. The court was very clear on that.
So people in foreign countries who are not U.S. citizens, they're not on U.S. soil, but the constitutional protections that we enjoy as citizens apply to them. So would they have standing under the standard you've just articulated to file suit against the U.S. government on the grounds that say, I don't know, we bombed their country? So Iraqis with visas in hand, because our protections apply to them, why wouldn't they be able to sue in federal court in the U.S. for, I don't know, waging war against them?
Sure, Tucker, your hypothetical is interesting. I think it is a world away from the instant executive order related to immigration. The executive order related to immigration and the judge's ruling on due process made it clear that with respect to any person in the United States, citizens, residents, or folks who have been issued visas, whether they be in the states or not in the states, they are required under the law to be protected by due process, notice, and an opportunity to be heard.
So there's nothing theoretical, but I beg your pardon, about the example I just gave. I mean, if they have due process rights, the same ones you and I as U.S. citizens possess, those rights do not just apply to the president's executive orders or to immigration. They apply to the whole panoply of rights granted us by the Constitution. That's a big deal. That means that tens of thousands, potentially millions of people around the world, not allowed to vote here, do not live here, have standing in U.S. courts as citizens. Like, why is that not a huge thing?
Well, Tucker, it's because your hypothetical is so expansive and goes so far beyond the court's narrow application of the question presented that it's simply inapplicable. Why don't we focus on the case and the contesting of the executive order?
That's it. And I'm not a lawyer, so I'm just asking you a sincere question. So due process under the Constitution only applies to visas and immigration when those rights are curtailed by an executive order by the president.
That's what the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said.
Okay. So explain to me, if you would, in simple terms, what's legally wrong with the president's executive orders? Why are they against the Constitution, or what's the statutory problem with them?
Sure. There are several significant infirmities that the Ninth Circuit found. Number one, the government took the position that the executive order was unreviewable. The Ninth Circuit, citing cases going back to 50 years ago, made it clear that while a president's executive order that impacts national security and immigration is entitled to deference, it is reviewable under constitutional standards. That's point number one. Second point, standing. The court made clear that states have standing to bring actions against the federal government where the federal government's actions will impact the states. And the states of Washington and Minnesota presented compelling evidence of the impact on students at universities, professors at universities, employees, and businesses.
Okay. And that all seems reasonable. But I'm asking, what's the core legal or constitutional problem with the orders in the first place? Why do they contravene the Constitution or existing immigration law? I'm confused about that.
Okay, well, let me try to clear it up for you. What the court also found is that the rationale behind the executive order was not well established, in fact, by the government. The court pointed out and highlighted that in none of the seven countries at issue, Did the government present any evidence of any terrorist strike from those countries at the United to the United States? Under the court's review, under the Constitution, the government needed to provide that evidence and wholly failed to. That's another very important fact here.
Okay. So your position, because you signed on to this in the amicus brief, is that there is no threat from refugees or immigrants from, say, Somalia, even though there have been a couple of pretty recent cases where refugees from that specific country or their children have committed terror attacks or been arrested in terror plots. That's not real. There's no actual threat. It's made up. Is that the position?
No, my position is, and I heard the oral argument, which was an extraordinary teaching lesson in the Constitution, and the judges asked the government lawyer to provide it of evidence of any terrorist act from those seven countries. And as the opinion makes clear, the government provided no evidence.
I noticed that's exactly right. And that may have been a failure of preparation or a failure of sophistication. I mean, they clearly didn't do a good job defending their position. But I want to get back to what the core problem is. Now, you're hearing people argue that the problem with these executive orders is they specify, though indirectly, a religion. They set up a religious test for our immigration policy.
Well, I mean, I think this clip lays out pretty well what's going on. And the court becomes an activist when it goes beyond the statute, when it goes beyond the Constitution and or the U.S. Code. And so you could say, well, that's the, you know, one of the responses to that would be that's the common law. The common law expands, is constantly expanding the area that the law applies to. But if it contravenes, if it goes against the law, in other words, if the law says, for example, the president has the right to make these decisions, and then the court comes along and says, yeah, you may have the right, but you have to do 5 or 10 different criteria, you're really damaging the power of the president to act. And it seems to me like, and maybe you agree, maybe you don't, 5, 2, 3, 14, 50, it seems to me like it's a gang assault against Trump, and everybody's trying to discredit him. And this is an important moment for the left, because they've been able to discredit him on a legal standing, and everybody can say, well, you see here, this isn't just biased. You know, this court, this independent body that is, you know, their whole job is to apply the law, has come in and said Trump is way out of bounds. So it is a shame that the United States did not put on their A game, apparently, in this case, because of that, we may never know what could have happened here. And we do have a phone call here, but you know, it could happen in state court too. The judge can know that your argument is correct in general, but because you don't support it with law, then the judge can't rule on your side. But we've got a phone call. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Yeah, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Yeah, what I'm concerned about here is if this leftist court, California, can throw a monkey wrench into this situation, they could do the same thing with sanctuary cities. Wouldn't that be correct? I mean, ostensibly they could file a preliminary injunction halting enforcement or the lack of funds, federal funds going to sanctuary cities, the same way as they're doing this now. And an activist judge can say, no, you still have to spend them federal funds.
Yeah, are you asking?
Heard by the Supreme Court, you understand?
Yeah, no, if you're asking me a question, the answer is you could use the same logic. I don't see why you couldn't use the same logic and say this is too detrimental to these people, and it's, you know, it's not justified by the state's argument.
Yeah, and you can still have the same activist judges ruling the way activist judges want to rule. And the whole disconcerting thing about this is this sets precedence for treating illegals with due process and giving them constitutional rights, which is very, very, very dangerous, you know, because they're not American citizens, number one.
Yeah.
And then you're giving them these rights, and that's going to open up a whole Pandora's box.
Jeff, take a little breath here. The first thing that I thought of was, when I read this, was this globalism. Globalism seeks to do that. It seeks to put all people on the same level, and therefore there's nothing crazy about Nancy Pelosi going down to the border of Mexico and saying, you know, waving her arms back and forth, come in, Americans, come in, everybody's an American. I mean, I think that is, like you say, an extraordinarily dangerous thing.
In the respect that it gives them constitutional rights when they're of the American Constitution, when they are not Americans.
Exactly. Jeff, I got to take a break here. Anything else?
Nothing further. Thank you for your time.
Great call. All right, folks. I mean, look, if do you remember any of you who've read the Bible, then Paul is involved with basically the police or the government authorities, and somebody comes up and they're about to beat him or whatever, and he says, "Wait a minute, I'm a Roman citizen," and the guy says, "Oh my gosh, I please forgive me," kind of a thing. Roman citizenship had an extraordinary power. But how much power would it have had if it went around the if someone got up in the Roman Senate and said, "These ideas are so good, we've got to apply them to everybody around the world." No, that's not how you do it. That doesn't make any sense. You force people to come here to have those rights, you know, and if you're blocking them, then they don't have the rights yet. By definition, they didn't have the rights. 647, it's a philosophical argument, but a lot is riding on it. We'll be right back. 523-1450.
Oh, your dog gone ran and you went on home. You forgot about this and you forgot about that. You gotta get back to what you're doing.
Jeff Sessions sworn in as the Attorney General. Now, here's a response from Alan Dershowitz. Trump will likely win travel ban case at Supreme Court.
Welcome back. Question for you. What's in a name? Well, for one thing, the chance to mislead. The partisan press has inaccurately described President Trump's executive order to temporarily halt travel from 7 Mideastern countries as a Muslim ban. Now, some Christian leaders have bought into that description and announced their opposition. Miranda Kahn has more.
I don't know if this is the right clip, but I can get that up for you next hour. But I was listening last night to Dershowitz talking about this, and I mean the upshot is that the Supreme Court can just look at the powers that are given to the United States president and just decide off that. Now, here is, I think, the beginning of this thing, so I'll try to squeeze this in right now. Here's Alan Dershowitz, famous Harvard professor.
Several legal experts, this matter will likely head to the U.S. Supreme Court. J.D., back to you.
Thanks very much, Miranda. Well, let's call on one of those aforementioned legal experts. Famed attorney Alan Dershowitz, former professor at Harvard Law School, Newsmax contributor, author of the book Electile Dysfunction, A Guide for Unaroused Voters. So, Alan, we always appreciate your time. I understand that you appeared recently on CNN saying this executive order will create or cause chaos. Your reasons for that, sir?
No, I just think that overturning it now on a temporary basis, undoing the injunction that was granted in Seattle, would cause chaos. I think the government, when it ordered the airports to let people in and to act as if there was no order in effect, sealed their own fate, because you're not going to get a court to undo that and then have to undo it again if they come to a different decision. So I think the Trump administration will lose the initial battle about the stay, but I think they may very well win ultimately when it gets to the Supreme Court. I do not believe that this order constitutes a violation of the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. The fact that they picked the 7 Muslim states, those are the states that have high levels of terrorism. We're talking about Islamic terrorism. What did they have to do? Throw in Armenia or Israel in order to satisfy the Constitution? That's absurd. And then they exempted minority religions. Well, that makes a lot of sense. In 1945, the government passed a statute for the War Refugee Act, which was focused exclusively on Jews because Jews were the victims of the Holocaust. So when you focus on real victims or real perpetrators and the impact is heavily on one particular religion, that doesn't create a constitutional problem. So I think that the Trump administration will ultimately win on that issue, at least as it relates to people who have never been in the United States.
All right. So, you know, there's two sides to this thing, but you can't help but get a whiff of the social justice warriors, the snowflakes, the people that claim that the most important thing in when a law is involved is the outcome. And, you know, so I think people have to be ready. I'm sure that you are. Get ready for the long term with Trump. If you're a backer of his, if you're on the fence or maybe a skeptic, this thing is going to play out. It's going to be day after day of this. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450. We'll take a break on the hour, come back, and I'll have some New Mexico news for you when we come back.
An island is on your own, and you yell, hey, when the snow blew up, upset, why, yeah. Footprints on your team, and they're almost gone. And you're wondering why. Well, normally you head down, don't you cry. But your eyes are tired, and your feet are too. Wish the world was as kind as you. Or I'll write a letter and I'll send it away and put all the trouble.
All right, so you know that the house turned over and returned to the Democratic Party, and there were people locally who lost, including Dr. McMillan, et cetera. It was pretty hard-fought races, and there were some eye-raising ads that were put out, et cetera. But anyway, so this, the House and the Senate are still Democrat here. Now, according to the New Mexico Political Report, a state House of Representatives panel approved a bill that would keep local law enforcement agencies in New Mexico from enforcing federal immigration laws. And according to the bill, it would prohibit using state resources to be used against anyone whose only violation is being in the United States illegally, which passed on a 3-2 vote on party lines. And the problem that was brought up by the Republicans was that this is a poor state and it could jeopardize federal funding. And so the bill sponsor, State Representative Patricia Roy Ball Caballero, Democrat, Albuquerque, said that the state's funds are better used against local criminals than enforcing immigration laws. The federal laws and enforcement agencies already are given the job of doing. And she talked about her own story of being outside gardening in front of her house and that she was profiled when the police came by to check and see if she was a citizen. All right. Another New Mexico story. Steve Pierce, border wall won't work. Steve Pierce is one of the biggest supporters of Donald Trump in the general election. And yet when it comes to a wall between the United States and Mexico, he says you can come over it, come under it, go around it, go through it, and so it's not going to work. And Pierce has long been a critic of these idea of building a wall, and so it just goes to show you that there are disagreements within the party. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Yeah, it's Tom.
Hey, what's up, Tom?
Hey, I just wanted to know, have you watched any of the videos on protesters getting run over by vehicles?
No, no. Where's that happening at?
Oh, there's a bunch of them on the YouTube. There's like several videos of protesters actually getting run over. They'll block the road and cars will just start pushing and they'll start jumping on the car and hitting them with rocks and stuff and whatever they do.
But Tom, you're not mentioning what protest you're talking about.
The protests were Black Lives Matter and also with just people protesting Trump?
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but I just Googled it. Black Lives Matter protester hit by car, part one. And I have actually, now that you mention it, and during one of the Black Lives Matter protests, that, which I think was in California, there was a lady who was protesting near one of the universities, and she got way out in the road, and there were people who were trying to, you know, pass by and get away from the protesters or just go where they were going. And this lady kind of wandered out and was hit and left dazed in the road by the, I guess, the driver. But it appeared to be the protesters' fault. I think she was dressed in a tutu or something. I mean, she looked like she was already out of her mind.
It shows them plowing through these protesters at speed. And another one shows them going by and hitting one person in the street at a Black Lives Matter and then turning the car around and coming back and firing shots at them. It's unbelievable what's going on. And I don't know, what you being a lawyer, do you know if a bunch of people surround your car with rocks and start, you know, rocking your car, whatever, if you have the right to, you know, use the car as a weapon?
Well, I mean, nobody has the right to run somebody over in a general sense. There would be an analysis done if the driver was in danger or had a reasonable perception that they were in danger, then they could, you know, kind of push through it. There's a general principle in the law that in any conflict, you can use the same amount of force as the person. You can't bring a gun to a knife fight kind of a thing, but it would be case specific. But and now I'm looking at this. This is called cars running over ignorant protesters. And there's been 24,000 views on this thing, but I do see that they're going through them, like you say, at speed. So I would think that the analysis that they would do is they would look at the area where they were run over, and if it was in a highway, that would go to the benefit of the driver. If it was on a maintained road, that helps the driver because that's where you're supposed to be driving. But if the driver saw them and refused to stop, I think then you could easily get an assault charge or even an attempted murder. So it's fact specific.
You'll see them flying in the air and everything through the video.
Are you trying to get some free legal advice? Are you planning on plowing over a few people?
I don't want to do anything like that unless my life's in danger, where they're coming up to the car with rocks and stuff. And once they start nudging them, you can see them jumping up on the hood and then start to beat on the windshield with stones or some objects to start breaking into the car. So I believe they're going to pull you out of the car and do something, you know, beat you up or whatever the heck they're going to do. But, you know, your life is kind of in danger at that point.
That's when you pull, you put on your Hillary Rodham Clinton beanie.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom.
Take care,
all right, bye-bye. All right. A lot of this stuff, if you run somebody over at a protest, call an attorney before you turn yourself in. A lot of stuff like that's fact specific, you know. Kind of interesting. I mean, there are definitely people flying through the air. We do have another call. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Kelly, it's Ralph.
Ralph, good morning. Hope you're doing well. And what's going on?
Yeah, this is your last caller. Brought some memory back that what happened to me.
What happened?
The third attempted murder charge against me was not attempted murder. It was attempted homicide with a motor vehicle, 12 counts.
Wow.
My life wasn't in danger. They were in my way.
Well, I mean,
and,
blocking
a road.
Yeah.
To the hospital. And it was union. They wouldn't get off the road. So I just climbed up on a big old loader and ran right straight down the road, scattered them all out, 12 of them, and they charged me with attempted homicide with a motor vehicle, 12 counts.
Well, you see, you could get charged with that. So what was your defense based on?
I had a legal right to keep that road open.
Mm-hmm.
And that took care of it, and they dropped the charges.
What year was that?
Oh, that was in the 80s, I believe it was.
Huh. Well, you would have probably been out by now anyway, so.
No, I never worried about things like that. You know, had two prior attempted murders, and they were false charges. And I never served 1 minute behind bars on those. And I believe in self-defense. If somebody's rocking my car, you better believe they're going to get a lot of 240 grain bullets at them.
Well, that's
and
nice.
I keep enough ammo to make sure I won't run out. I think 5,000 rounds is sufficient.
That sounds good. Thanks, Ralph. Have a good day.
Likewise.
All right, folks. The analysis, at first it would be a police investigation, of course, in theory anyway. So they would determine whether, if somebody is, generally speaking, if you're driving down the highway and somebody, you know, is like walking across the road, they're not going to, you know, the assumption is going to be that if you ran them over, you probably didn't see them. So anyway, there's another clip here that says white guy runs over Ferguson protester. All right. So 1/3 of New Mexico, only 1/3 of New Mexico families are accessing child care help, according to a study by University of New Mexico Center for Education Policy Research. Ranking 10th in the nation. Anyway, it's a long article, but I found it somewhat boring. I was falling asleep during it. Go out and get that health care that the Constitution, that the Constitution promises you. Supreme Court agent rules against New Mexico in water fight, according to the Sun News. And an agent of the U.S. Supreme Court, according to this article on Thursday, finalized draft rulings in a case that pits Texas against New Mexico over water from the Rio Grande. And the main thing is that they didn't dismiss the case, so it's still going on, and the Supreme Court itself has got to weigh in on it. Let's take a little break here. 717 AM, Las Cruces, AM 1455, 23, 1450. Little George Heartache, great song. Be right back.
I'm here out of love, and I wish I could stay. But I know you, heartache, you stand in my way.
Something country. Brooklyn 99.5 is Southern New Mexico's new choice for country, and we're glad you found us. Now, we are about 10 minutes away and 30 seconds from getting a front row seat. Up next, we've got the Nashville News on the way for you. Lots of Grammy news over at ZetaCountry.com if you're wondering about the movie. Skinny Jesse is now. Good morning with 99.5.
So they've got this new judge, Gorsuch, is quoted having said to a senator when the you know, the Supreme Court judges go around, the would-be judges go around and talk to the senators and the congressmen, but it's the Senate's job to vote on those. And he supposedly said something along the lines of it was a bad thing for the way Trump was attacking the judiciary, which I thought was kind of strange. Obviously, in the senator who asked him was Blumenthal from Connecticut, and he obviously got him to comment on it and then said that, then repeated it. It's, you know, mind if I repeat this? Well, go ahead, Senator. So I thought it was, you know, it was not a good thing, not a good look for Gorsuch to, it would have been better to say something along the lines, I'd prefer not to comment on something that I may have to rule on, would be an appropriate, you know, rule on in the near future. But, and there was some questions whether the White House set him up to do that so he could seem independent, but anyway, I played these yesterday, but I want to play them again. Here is, you know, supposedly, here's my worry is that there's so many attacks against Trump, and it seems that it makes it all the attacks seem justified. And, you know, there has been this kind of revolutionary fervor and this kind of sense of rightness that the media and Hollywood and, the popular culture has attached to leftism, no matter how terrible the actual facts are. There's this idea has been out there for a long time. If you're a good person, you're a leftist. And that breeds in people's minds a natural reaction to support and see, you know, to see these people in these movements as something positive when they ought to be analyzed on what the position is, you know. But so you've got this kind of default support of leftism that is so deeply rooted so that when the Supreme Court supports the, you know, blocking the ban, then there's this natural reaction out of people, you know, damn right, you know, even if it's an illegal decision by the Court of Appeals. In other words, if it goes against the law. But remember Obama saying this at the State of the Union with the Supreme Court standing directly in front of him, maybe 10 or 15 feet away.
Deference to separation of powers. Last week, the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections.
Well, with as many lefties as on the Supreme Court, none of them jumped up and started clapping because people don't like to be attacked, especially it was especially inappropriate to do that while they were there and to force them. And I think it's long been my theory, the reason that the Chief Justice John Roberts did not strike down Obamacare is because he believed that Obama would have led a movement to discredit him personally. I think he would have, because that was Obama's great achievement, was Obamacare. Now here he takes on the Supreme Court again, a group of unelected people. This is light years beyond in terribleness of attacking judges and the institution of the U.S. judiciary, and nobody is even playing these clips. I don't know, you know. I think the media, the right media, if you want to call it that, is still asleep at the wheel.
So there's not only a economic element to this and a legal element to this, but there's a human element to this. And I hope that's not forgotten in this political debate. Ultimately, I'm confident that the Supreme Court will not take what would be an unprecedented, extraordinary step of overturning a law that was passed by a strong majority of a democratically elected Congress. And I just remind conservative commentators that for years what we've heard is the biggest problem on the bench was judicial activism or a lack of judicial restraint, that an unelected group of people would somehow overturn a duly constituted and passed law.
How about an unelected group of people just banned the ban that was put out by the president when it's in his ambit, it's within his purview to decide what the rules are going to be. So, all right, let me ask you this. If you get rid of this ban, does that mean that the president can't stop people from coming into the country? You know, they can't. This is just so mind-boggling. If he discovers, I would hope anyway, if he discovers this group of ISIS people that are planning on coming here, I would like to think that the Supreme Court would get out of the way and allow the president to stop them. But I mean, it's in general, you've got to have this type of thing, right? President has to be able to make those decisions, even if you dislike the president, like a lot of people do, and even if you've turned it into an industry to attack him and say what an evil person he is, doesn't it matter that he has the right to make decisions based on being elected? I mean, where is this great respect for democracy that the Democrats always claim they have? 727, Kelly O'Connell, I am Las Cruces, and I'll have some news for you right here.
Could I satisfy? I'm fit to be misfit when you're at my side.
Hey, it's Kelly. Who's this? Hey, it's Kelly. Who's this?
Kelly, good morning. This is Bill.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, I got a question for you.
All right.
Why doesn't he just rewrite this executive order and sign another one?
Yeah, man, that's another possibility. But, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Hey, I say he could crank these out two or three a day.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I have one other question for you.
Ahead.
Is this going to be your last day?
No.
Oh, good. They extended you?
Well,
and your show's going to go on?
Yeah, but I never said today was going to be my last day.
Well, I heard you say comment they wanted you to stick around a couple more weeks.
Oh, yeah. No, that's yeah. Yeah, I'll be back Monday.
All right. Outstanding.
Thanks, Bill.
You have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye. All right, so everybody knows what the rule of law is. It's this idea that there is, well, let me backtrack a little bit. Everybody knows what, or should know what, the natural law is. The natural law is the theory that there is a law above the law. And that the natural law is it's inside the universe everywhere, but it's especially inside human activity, that it's either active or it's potentially active. It's active if human beings apply it. Now, an application or an example of the natural law, a part of the natural law, would be the Ten Commandments. Is kind of a think you can think of the Ten Commandments as being a holograph of the entire law. As if you go to the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about applying the natural Ten Commandments, and it's very powerful. Probably the most powerful natural law argument you'll ever hear. Now, it is not just a Christian doctrine, though, because a lot of the natural law comes out of the Greeks and Romans. And so, in any event, on the opposite of that is what the writer Alasdair MacIntyre calls emotivism. It's a philosophical doctrine, but all it really stands for is the idea that your emotions are consistent with or in agreement with the truth. And it is both a very attractive doctrine and also wildly dangerous. And I mean, it's very dangerous to say, the things that I like are good. The things I have a flavor for, I have a taste for, the things that make me feel good are right. Things that I did, make me feel bad or wrong. It's, there's no substance to it. It just goes off of people's whims or off their emotions or off their instincts. And the rule of law is the opposite of that. The rule of law is what it is. And the rule of law is basically an application of the natural law. The idea that there are a set of precepts or there are a set of rules that are beyond all other laws is in the Christian sense is shown in the Ten Commandments. But if you roll it into a secular example, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are this take the kind of the same place. And that's why when we talk about whether a law is legal, we are invariably in America talking about ultimately whether it's constitutional. And as you see, the court is talking about the Fourth and Fifth and Sixth Amendments, I'm trying to remember which amendment they applied here. I guess it would be the Fourth Amendment, but due process is one of the things that was mentioned, but another thing that was mentioned is life, liberty, and property. So in any event, you see how powerful the idea of the rule of law is when you see an example of it, the Constitution, and how so many people in this country have been saved by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And without a Bill of Rights, without a Constitution, everybody's a sitting duck in front of the government. And so the court turns around and says, we're going to decide what's the proper set of criteria for the president to use to make up his decisions on, foreign policy. That's something that they don't really have, according to the Constitution or the U.S. Code. That's not their area to concern themselves with. So you've got this emotivism creeping in, this idea, and this guy in Washington runs children's clinic. What could be more emotionally trying or satisfying than working in a legal clinic that specializes in children with mental health issues? I mean, talk about coming home at night saying, tough job, but boy, I really feel like I'm working on something important. A person who does pro bono work on immigration, that person is probably not a radically conservative individual, right? So you've got the same guy who's getting up and saying Black Lives Matter. You've got judges who are putting themselves into cases. They're getting emotionally involved, and they're doing it because it feels great. A judge who says every case is about me is going to feel very connected to his cases or her cases. But at the same time, don't you need some distance to be able to judge? If you're doing pro bono work in immigration, maybe if a case comes up in front of you, you give it to somebody else. You see what I mean? And so this is this emotivism, that emotion you take. Since here's the argument. This is what I want to throw out to you, whether you want to, call in about it or not, or just kind of let it kind of nestle around in the back of your brain for thinking about later. Here's my argument. Leftism does not have a legal theory in it. It doesn't really have a Ten Commandments, right? And I got a book, and I'm trying to remember who the name of the author is. It's long out of print, but it was kind of interesting. But I was looking up Marxist ethics and law and morality and everything. And one of what the guy said in this book was, there are no rules that cannot be broken in Marxism. For example, in some instances, it is okay to kill or or murder. So that's not true in our way of thinking in the West, in rule of law country. You know, the political system doesn't dominate the law in the West. The law is supposed to dominate the political system and make it possible. The political system takes life. It takes its structure through the laws, right? So in leftism, you throw the law out the window, whether you mean to or not. That's the result. And you buy into these kind of feel-good theories. It's emotivism. I'm going to go after what my heart tells me is right. Like Elizabeth Warren, you're not going to stop me from talking. You're not going to silence me. Well, suddenly the big deal is freedom of speech for women. Although previously the Democrats have shown 10,000 different attempts to get rid of free speech by bringing in speech codes, by bringing in political correctness, by threatening to prosecute people who say the wrong thing. So you see, there's no set firm foundation in liberalism, which is what makes it dangerous. And when you see it applied in the USSR, you see it applied in China, you see hundreds of millions of people that are executed. Well, now, how is that possible? Why is that? Well, you get rid of the law, but if you're getting rid of the law, you're getting rid of religion too, right? Because it's within religion that we find these so-called Ten Commandments: thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery. It doesn't say thou shalt not murder unless you get angry or something. You see what I'm saying? So in leftism, it's dangerous because anything can happen to justify the political order or the movement. And we have another call. Thanks for the call. The Kelly O'Connell Show is this.
This is Donna.
Donna, what's going on?
Well, I just want to comment on your comment about the liberals and left operating by their heart. You know, whatever feels good, whatever they feel is right.
Yeah.
The Bible says in Jeremiah, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? That's why we need the rule of law.
Right. Anything else?
Well, yes. Title 8, Title 18 of the U.S. Code 2101 comments on people that incite a riot or aid and abet a riot. And I think we need to hold the people responsible that aid and abet the riots and the mayhem, like the people at Berkeley University, University of California at Berkeley, that said to the police, stand down and let these rioters do whatever they want. So they did $100,000 worth of damage to property and also to policemen and to bystanders.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I don't know why Trump didn't do that, but maybe as he gets more in control of the system, he'll be able to do it.
Hope so.
Thanks, Donna. Have a good day. All right, folks, we'll take a little break here. But so you see what I'm getting at. I think that the one of the problems that we've had in this culture is it's not that we're fundamentally stupid. It's that we haven't had the right training. And so to get trained in these issues, you have to go out and buy books and all this stuff, all this type of thing. We're not trained in school how to think. We're in the current school system and the current media, we're trained to react and be propaganda, you know, puppets. And so part of becoming an adult is taking on this task of learning how to learn and learning how to think and then educating yourself about history. And history is full of examples where socialism doesn't work, you know, but that's just part of it. The other part of it is socialism kills a lot of people. And if you let that get out of your mind, you're never going to understand the true heart of socialism. It is absolute control. It is seeking absolute control in such a maniacal way that the entire world is burned to cinder. You know, that's because if you see these revolutions, they always turn in on themselves. The revolutionaries all end up getting killed after the revolution is or even during the revolution. So, and we do have a call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Hey, Kelly, it's Greg.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, I just want to concur with Donna. That is absolutely true about the heart. Secondly, I think the Trump administration made a big mistake not including Saudi Arabia in that list.
Yeah, but there's a reason that they didn't do it, because Saudi Arabia is our buddies. But, I mean, so the question is, could they reformat it with different countries in it?
Well, they better, and they better take another plan of attack, because it just rings true, because of Saudi Arabia, for the love of money is the root of all evil.
Okay. All right, great.
Thank you.
Thanks. Have a good day.
Kelly.
Yeah, bye, folks. I got some California weather and then local weather.
Flooding is becoming a huge issue in parts of California. You see this drone video. You've got some vineyards on the left side of the screen there, and, of course, a road that's completely covered up. You know, not only has it been river flooding causing problems, but just the amount of rain that we've had. Look at this. That's actually real-time video of a landslide that actually destroyed a house. So, you know, you get the ground so saturated, and all of a sudden it starts to give way, especially where you've got some terrain, these landslides, mudslides blocking roads and things like that. We've still got a lot of moisture streaming into California, at least for the next 24 hours or so. I think we'll catch a little bit of a break by the time we get to the weekend, but we've still got some more rain and, of course, snow in the high terrain to get through. Keep in mind, through all this stuff and all these bad things that are happening, this is chipping away at the drought little by little, and we've done some really good work on the drought. I know these numbers don't look huge, especially as far as the rain goes, but I think there will be some heavier bands of rain that'll set up that'll drop some more than this. A little bit over a foot of snow in the Sierra left to go.
All right, switching gears here. Question, could we send the nuclear radiation that we have, that we create on the Earth, into the sun? And this is from universetoday.com. And so the Earth, sun is pretty hot. It could burn up anything, pretty much. And there's a lot of stuff that's created by nuclear energy, you know, the hospitals and the use of nuclear waste or nuclear fuel for creating energy, and also the defense industry. So when this stuff is used up, it's still done It's done with from a practical perspective, but it is still highly radioactive, a lot of it. According to the World Nuclear Association, OPEC nations generate 300 million tons of toxic waste every year. Poisonous chemicals, medical waste, coal dust, anything you don't want to be near, that's what it is. Out of this, only 97,000 tons of nuclear waste is generated across the planet. Only 0.03% of the entire toxic waste. Now, most radioactive material is high-level waste produced by nuclear reactors. That's about 12,000 tons per year, or 12% of nuclear waste. Now, launch costs. What would it take to launch this stuff into the sun? Most rocket companies will charge $10,000 to $20,000 per kilogram to blast a payload into low Earth orbit. The best deal on the market is SpaceX, although it just blew up a rocket. $4,000 USD per kilogram. And if you get the Falcon Heavy flying, Falcon Heavy is the biggest one, could bring it down to $2,500 per kilogram. If we wanted to blast all this waste into low Earth orbit, the calculation is simple. 12,000 tons, 12 million kilograms, multiplied by 2,500 per kilogram, $30 billion. And that would be 240 Falcon Heavy launches per year, almost a launch every day or every third day. Now, lots of money, but, well, let's take a little break here and I'll tell you the rest of the story. Kelly O'Connell talking about blowing stuff into the sun and getting the worst stuff off the planet. Is it feasible? Only $30 billion a year. Come on, let's chip in. We'll be right back. 750.
Party, find another place to be. I'm tired of being your best
friend. All right, so getting rid of all of the nuclear waste into the sun would be a little bit expensive. So to get it out of nuclear out of orbit into low Earth orbit would be one thing, but to get it into the sun would be 20 times as expensive, and you can't really shoot it directly into the sun. What you'd have to do, according to this article anyway, is you'd have to shoot it out so that it's passing the sun and then gets sucked into the orbit and then is drawn in and then incinerated. So the amount of money that it would take to do that every year is $1.2 trillion to launch the high-level waste in the center, a trajectory that takes a long time. Now, I think 95% of the rocket launches would be successful, but what about the other 5%? I mean, then you've got this stuff coming back to Earth. So anyway, it was a good idea while it lasted. All right, here's another article. Magma power. Scientists are going to drill into a volcano to harness its energy, and they're doing this in Iceland. At the Reykjanes Peninsula, a volcanic system there. It's been dormant 700 years. And the depths of that field have never been explored, but they feel like it is within the ability to tap down into it. And geothermic energy uses the heat trap beneath the Earth's surface to generate electricity. Conventional geothermal energy utilizes steam from natural sources such as geysers or by drawing water from the hot, high-pressure depths of the Earth. Hot vapors then drive turbines. But in the case of volcanic geothermal energy, something that you may have also thought about like I did, the same as you wanting to shoot all the terrible stuff on Earth into the sun. The heat comes from supercritical water. Researchers explain that energy from so-called supercritical water is much higher than conventional geothermal steam. When molten rock and water meet, the extreme heat and pressure bring water to a supercritical state, where it is neither liquid nor gas. In this form, the water can carry more energy than normal steam, which could create up to 10 times the power output of the other geothermal sources. And researchers are going to continue to look into this. And they've said, quote, if deep supercritical wells here and elsewhere in the world can produce more power than conventional geothermal wells, fewer wells could be needed to produce the same power output, leading to less environmental impact and improved economics. And geothermal energy is a major source of energy in Iceland, producing 25% of the country's electricity. And in its 2016 power production report, the Geothermal Energy Association, GEA, found only 6 to 7% of global geothermal power potential has been tapped. I can't believe it's that much. Well, right now you've got a volcano in Hawaii that is pouring, absolutely pouring like out of a hose, magma. And it's just like flying into the ocean. So we have a lot of geothermal history in this state. Could we tap into that? And over in the lava fields, beneath the lava fields that are between here and Roswell, there is an from what I understand from the research I've done, there's a lava field down there that's still molten hot, and I wonder if you could tap down into that one, if it's close enough to the surface. Or, on the other hand, if you tap down into it, would there be a danger of or awakening a sleeping monster? You know, careful what you ask for, right? Well, thanks for tuning in. We talked about, to a large extent, the order, the ban of the ban of Trump's ban. And so the question is, where is he going to go with it? And how is he going to get this next person on the court? And guy already more liberal than people think, because he's already criticizing Trump, which is kind of a stupid thing to do, but in my opinion. But maybe they decided that he would do it to show that he was independent. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. It's getting warmer out there, and we're going to be in spring before you know it. Enjoy your weekend. Have a good one. We'll meet back in 2 days, and we'll talk to you then. Ciao. AM Las Cruces, Kelly O'Connell Show.
Our best friend, look to another. When you do my thing, will it? You know there's nowhere at all. I'm feeling no pain. My body is sickly. My mind is insane. Okay.